the one that was left out is the one I'm proposing. You never lived in an extended family of your own blood relatives.
No, because my parents were dead. My brother was... When I came back from India, I lived in my own hometown for 4 or 5 years till I got married. And that was a sense... rerouting myself in my ancestral territory. I mean, extended families only really work when they're coupled with being connected to the land and the traditions of the place where you're born, your native place. As soon as you have people moving hundreds of miles to get jobs or get away from their parents, and then parents moving off in America, the return of the extended family would involve the sky's dark with jumbo jets flying from Florida, bringing back all these grandparents and senior citizens who are there in their droves, and dispersing them back to where their children are. But this kind of thing, this dispersal caused by cars, mobility, social change, urban, starting with the Industrial Revolution and urbanization, means that the basis for this, namely geographical connection, connectedness to a place, isn't there. Well, I did try that too, but living in a small town in the English Midlands, it did indeed appeal to me. I like it. I still have a house there. But I actually tried that experiment, to connecting with those members of my family who do still live there. And my, but it wasn't sufficiently satisfying in my case.
Well, it may be that there is no solution by going back to old models. It's important to remember that the average person 100 years ago who was 50 years old was dead, and that we must reinvent our lives at least 3 times. Most people in most traditional societies were dead at age 45 or 50. And so these problems, temporary solutions were fine because life itself had a temporary quality. You didn't have to create solutions that would last 75 years or 60 years. This is an unheard of dilemma for human beings that is very recent. And I dare say we're not doing too well with it.
Well, the fantasy of recreating a new version of extended family, this was, of course, one of the main features of the hip subculture in the 60s and the commune idea. And when that experiment failed, I felt a great loss, because that was somehow, as far as daily life is concerned, the most important aspect. And when it vanished, there was no replacement.
Why did it fail?
So I now feel that I do have an extended family. I have wonderful and close friends, and they're all over the place. Where I live, there's no one. There's my partner Ray nearby, but we're really isolated. And there have been, after I acknowledged that the telephone and the jet plane will not maintain family, I have thought many times about moving, other people moving, and somehow re-aggregating in a common geographical location, no matter if it had a tradition for any of us or not. And if we were free to do this, we could actually create extended family. We would have to have enough money to buy the real estate, put the houses and so on, where we could essentially create our own village, voluntary communities. And this would require even a greater level of mobility than we even have now, because we are too bound where we are to even do this. So life is passing, the years are going on, and the dream of having an extended family is receding farther and farther, as no one has been able to organize one.
Maybe this explains the remarkable attraction that computer networking has for some people, that it's an incipient virtual extended family, and could be made more explicitly real if this were raised into consciousness.
Really, really explicitly real, and you found that your needs for community was completely satisfied in this way. When you came finally to parent, if you were a woman and you're going to have one child, you still find no way to do it. You have no family support for the actual parenting that goes in a room or two in a house somewhere. Your family is too far away. So I came to the conclusion that old-fashioned, antique, geographical proximity is the only way to have real family.
And real community.
Yes.
And there's a very good analysis by Wendell Berry in one of his essays about the way in which the modern cash economy has grown up precisely through fragmentation of those things that are most important to human beings, namely the sense of community, family, closeness of connection to nearest and dearest. As soon as you begin to fragment communities, people still have those needs. So in order to re-establish them, they need telephones, cars, jet planes, the travel business, and they now have to spend billions of dollars, hundreds of billions in aggregate, to do what were done free before, namely meeting neighbours on the street and talking to friends. So this fragmentation, he argues, is the very basis of modern cash capitalist society, is precisely based on fragmenting the things which are dearest and most important to us, because then to recover the pieces, to try and put them back together again, we have to travel hundreds of miles, spend a lot of money on jet, burn lots of gasoline, travel hundreds of miles on highways to recover just momentarily, for brief periods, the things which are the common birthright of most people in most parts of the world.
So this is part of the factor of 800 to 1,000.
Yes. It's very closely related to the high consumption patterns, because what most people want most of the time are these things of nearness, closeness, friends, talking to people, chats, being in groups where you feel at home, at ease, among friends. Now to do it, you have to earn lots of money, and then you have to drive a long way along Highway 1, spending lots of money on gasoline, polluting the atmosphere, to come to Esalen for a weekend, so you can get that feeling of togetherness in a group and sense of and then disperse again, and then earn more money so you can come back again.
So in future, our society has got to abandon mobility. It's a failed experiment.
Well, we are in the act of doing that. Maybe we're over the hump. It sounds like it was the automobile that destroyed all this, and perhaps the new electronic technologies, of which it is always said they are shrinking the world, they are knitting us all together into one, are in fact overcoming the dispersion which took place under the aegis of the mechanical technologies of steam and petrol.
Well, it's fine to blame the automobile or the train, but I think actually we have an addiction to travel. We love it. We love to get on the plane and go somewhere far away and have an experience which we later describe as very illuminating and developing.
God, we complain about it constantly.
Well, we don't need to do it. You see, traditionally, in an Indian village or somewhere, you can have the experience of the other or the new by going on foot for
yes.
a day.
So I agree it's unnecessary, but I think that now we're in a state of addiction, so in order to recover, to abandon mobility, we're going to have to kind of use a 12-step program, not just blame the automobile or the Industrial Revolution. I, first of all, volunteered to go to college some 1,000 miles away from home when there were excellent colleges nearby. My father was extremely angry about this. He knew this was wrong, and that was just one step, as he thought, to going even further, and that's true. Then I took my first job. It was in California, another couple thousand miles farther from home, and here I am still flying to Vermont once a year to replenish my family relations.
But if we assume that these electronic technologies are going to continue in along this line of obliterating time and space, then it's reasonable to assume that in a generation or so, this is going to lose its force, and that if you want to see Mom, Mom will be there in
yes,
her
well,
virtual totality.
It won't work
properly.
It won't work. Because we've been hearing for decades, well, at least 10, 20 years, you know, how telephones and computers and all this. Well, you can work anywhere. You can be a stockbroker living in the depths of the country. Yet, in London, Still, the City of London's full of commuter trains coming in the mornings. All the stockbrokers still work there. They don't work in the depths of the country. Businessmen can communicate by fax, computer, telephone, anywhere in the world, yet jet planes are full of businessmen going to meetings around the world.
Well, but that's only half of it. I mean, I live in a rural area, and I'm surrounded by stockbrokers and screenwriters and the executives of major corporations, and they are in fact, they rarely go to the office, and they are realizing this dream of diffuse, you know, the obliteration of the town-country distinction. Well, it's happening.
Why do you live in London? Why not stay in Newark?
Well, in my own case, I'd rather stay in Newark. Joel likes living in London.
But it's completely unnecessary.
Outside the village, that's one thing that gives mobility.
That's traditionally one advantage of London as opposed to the country is that I hate cars, you see, and so I don't have one. Joel has one, but I hardly ever drive. Living in London, I can walk Merlin into school, I can walk to the shops, I take public transport to where I go. Everyone I know who lives in the country to get into rural simplicity, in fact, spends most of their life in a car. I spend probably an hour a week in a car at home, if that. And so rural simplicity, as I actually see it among my friends, in fact means total dependence on mechanized transport. And people who live in villages in the country in England have to drive their kids to school, they have to drive them to play with friends and so on. In London, or any town, if you live in any town of the European kind, rather than a sprawling suburb predicated on a car, in traditional, ours is a Victorian area, the whole thing was built and on the assumption that everyone would primarily be moving around on foot. So we're able, at least in England, to live in cities where you've got the old type of planning, which is based on foot transport together with trains and public transport. You can get by fine like that. So that, for me, is a good reason for living in a city. Lower energy consumption, less time spent dependent on mechanized transport. So I think that there's a sense in which living in the country is one of these illusions of closeness to nature, which is in partly true.
But living in a village, like, I haven't been to Newark, but in a village, you can live in the village as opposed to in the countryside, 10 miles outside of the village.
Yes, I think living in a rural community.
And then you can go around on foot doing most things, if you don't need spare parts for your computer or something. So most of the time you could do that. You could walk to the train station if you needed to go to London.
Yes.
So wouldn't that be an alternative?
Well, it would, yes, except one of the problems with villages in most of England is that because increasing numbers of people have cars and because there's increasing less and less employment within villages, because agriculture has now become mechanised agribusiness, whereas the whole village would have been based on agriculture, now you've got two farmers who own all the farmland and do it with one assistant each. The rest of the population of the village are either commuters or retired people, which means that there's no longer a kind of base of people who live and work in the village, and therefore very few young children's schools, shops have closed down in a lot of
villages. Villages are dying, in short.
Villages are becoming commuter suburbs, dormitories.
But I think there's just a lag here in implementing available technology. In 15 years, I'll bet these villages aren't dying. Most of those commuters will be working at their keyboards, and the flow of population movement will have changed. Those English villages will be tremendously desirable, like the small towns of Northern California. Just in the time I've been living up there, I've seen them go from dying communities based on apple growing and wine to Mercedes ghettos inhabited by stockbrokers and computer programmers who do all their work over the telephone lines.
Well, not all. I bet you they travel. Everyone I know who lives in remote areas spends a fortune on traveling. They still have to go to meetings in New York, San Francisco, London, etc., and spend enormous amount of time traveling.
But I think this is, again, it's that they don't actually need to. It's that the companies they work for have not grown up with the available technologies. People most meetings could be handled electronically. It's simply, I mean, for instance, we all work for Bertelsmann, the largest publisher in the world, and apparently they're still doing most of their work on battered Underwoods. When, you know, this is laughable. So it isn't that there aren't solutions, it's that there's a perverse resistance to the available solutions.
All right, so one way of recovering some sense of the extended family is to have locally based communities.
Yes.
Reduced mobility.
Thanks to the computer revolution that telecommuting does enable a mass diffusion from cities back to villages that seems to be well underway in California. So that's some hopeful note.
My publishers in New York insist that I come to New York at least once a year to talk to them, and it's all
we have lunch and we say
the same things we've said the week before on the telephone, and then they're satisfied. But it's just a ritual. It has no there's no raison d'être for it at all, except to reassure them.
Isn't there something about physical proximity? Maybe the exchange of pheromones. Maybe the coupling of local morphic fields or something, body fields, auras. There's something about it which the electronic revolution hasn't yet replaced. And that's why I think all these businessmen are jetting around the world to meetings. They could do most of it by fax or teleconferencing. The fact is that these things haven't, for most people, yet worked. And it's because there's some need they don't satisfy. When I went to visit the Xerox Corporation headquarters last year, I gave a talk to them on morphic resonance. Both in Silicon Valley and in their Cambridge Research Centre in England, they're seriously concerned with this. They think they're seriously concerned that all these potentials of the computer and telecommunication revolution haven't in fact materialised to anything like the extent people were predicting a decade ago. And so they've now hired psychologists from universities to look into what is it in social interaction which is important to people, including subconscious clues. And what they've done now is it's laughable, really. I mean, in the centre in Cambridge, they have in every office, they have a video camera, and they have a screen. And you can see everybody in all the different offices by flicking and nod. You can see everybody else, so when you're talking to them you can have them on the screen, but you can also watch what they're doing. But so that it doesn't invade people's privacy too much, whenever anyone has you on the screen or you're about to come on their screen, you hear a noise like a creaking door, which indicates someone's looking at you, and then you can see who it is. And so they've tried, and then they found that most people's most meaningful and constructive and creative interactions happened around the coffee machine, when they actually met physically almost by chance. So they've created a kind of virtual coffee machine space on this thing, where people can meet, as it were, by chance, as a kind of virtual coffee machine. So they're trying to do this, but it's so laborious, so artificial, and so pathetic, that you can see what they're trying to do. They're trying to address this question. At least they've realised there's some appalling deficiency in this kind of communication that leaves most people deeply unsatisfied. There's something about physical proximity that hasn't been substituted. This visual thing is a step to make it more so, but even that is clearly unsatisfying. And still, most people, with all this with all these expensive gadgets, do most of their talking by the real coffee machine.
Yes, well, I personally urgently long for a real village. I don't even know one to move to. And a real village with my friends in it, and I think my life will be unfulfilled if this is never achieved. And not only I wish it for myself, but for the whole planet, the reversal of the trend of dying villages and growing cities.
Well, you must move to Occidental, Ralph. We'd love to have you.
Yes, or Hampstead.
Yes.
You're right. It gives me great satisfaction to know everyone in that town and have a first name exchange with the girl who bags my groceries and the guy who pumps my gas and so forth. I don't think that's an unrealizable dream for you at all.
It's not even unrealizable in cities. If you look at traditional cities like Siena in Italy, traditional medieval cities are based on a whole series of neighborhoods. And you get this also with, in Indian cities, you have bastis, which are like villages within the city. They're villages where everyone knows everyone. There's the local shopkeeper, you know, local potter, and local this and local that. And so the traditional model of city life is of tight-knit communities, which have the qualities of a village. Hampstead in London, it's called Hampstead Village, and has something of that quality. I know most of my neighbours, say hello to the people in the shops, you know, they know me, conversations. You see the same people year after year. This does happen.
The village in New York is called...
Yes, when I stay with people there.
It was a real busty.
It still is. I'm amazed when I stay with my friend in Greenwich Village and we go out for coffee. To me, it's this teeming city of millions of people. I wouldn't expect to ever encounter anyone I know. And his entire experience is of greeting people, inquiring how their business and health is going, and he knows who these people are. And he's only lived there 4 or 5 years, so there is... people do create community even in the most visually unlikely environments.
And they try to do it even in suburbs. You see, I think the suburb represents the attempt to create a community which is a village, but actually it's neither town nor
no,
country.
That's right. It's a failure.
That is predicated on the car, and we can blame the car for the sprawling suburbs, which then, in order for people to get anywhere or do anything, they have to use their cars, go to shopping malls, take kids to school, that kind of thing. So the traditional model of cities and the traditional model of villages both have this local community as a key feature of them, which provides some of the qualities of the extended family. And usually the extended family lived in the local community, so it was...
So is what we're concluding that to overcome the alienation among the between the genders, it's a technological and demographic
problem. City planning and demographics, and we need a kind of a 12-step program to escape our addiction to mobility. To minimize it. I mean, once a year to cross the country to see everybody you know there is certainly acceptable. And perhaps this is already happening. And Wendell Berry and people like this are revisioning the structure of entire nations.
Well, Esalen is a village. And
Esalen is a resort.
But there is a large, seemingly stable population. I mean, I know more people per square foot of Esalen than anywhere else on Earth that I recognize. I've been coming here so long, it's hard for me to convince myself that there's a large throughput of people because there always seem to be the same people.
Mm. After villages are reinstated and people give up mobility and our village becomes our extended family, I have a fear that there is still some problem about how to organize co-parenting and partnership of the genders within households that we have not solved.
Well, the question that's a really interesting one now is whether the revival... And we've tried androgyny, it's been tried by many people, and it's worked up to a point, but it, as you point out, it's been associated with, in fact, the demise of the nuclear family, in the sense that most marriages now end in divorce in certain parts of the world, like here. In Britain, I think it's 45% of marriages end in divorce. I think in the United States, it's about 52% or something. In other parts of Europe, it's less. Britain's the highest in Europe, the closest to America. So the old model is obviously crumbling, and this androgyny move hasn't saved it. In fact, it may have made it worse. So now we have the question of, do these new rediscoveries of male and female myths, a process only been going on some 10 years, and in the case of the men's movement, only 2 or 3 years, and in fact only in the last year has it reached sort of mainstream consciousness. Is this process likely to meet with more success in stabilizing gender relationships. The androgynous model creating a kind of fluctuating emulsion of roles with no role models or no sense of identity or no norms. Can that give way to a new model that's somehow related to much more ancient mythic patterns? That's the experiment that's currently being tried. No one knows how it'll turn out, but it's a new experiment, and it's because the consciousness of in this new form of post-feminist male roles and so on is something only just developing. So what would you rate its chances of success, Ralph? Probably low, given your preference for the liberal androgynous model.
No, I think that people will accept rather than deny the observed term of marriage. They will, upon deciding to have a child, make a sort of premarital agreement, as it were, with clauses in the contract as to where the child will go and what will happen in case of a separation. That among these agreements might be an agreement to stay in the same village. This would be one of the main stabilizing forces for villages in future. Because now the tendency is, after the dissolution of a marriage, that the partners move to different villages because they don't want to see each other or something. So that would be, I think, a stabilizing thing, the acceptance rather than the denial of the shorter-term marriage, the provision of conditions that would preserve the extended family even when the nuclear family disintegrates, not moving too far. Then the children would be able to walk back and forth between different parents' households, other friends, nephews, relatives, and close people, and so on, all within walking distance in the village. And maybe this is a kind of a negative view, but I like this. I never accepted the marriage institution in my life as something fundamentally correct. So in this context, with the extended family secure and the pressures released from the nuclear family, I think people could join for a short time in parenting, understanding if it became very uncomfortable to live in the same house, they just live in different houses, and the impact on the children of such separation would be much smaller. This would be an increased mobility on the village scale.
And if this were going on simultaneously with what we discussed last night, a much greater commitment to have only one child, the psychological stress and the financial demands on all parties, I think it would all feed together into a somewhat happier situation.
People wouldn't need to adopt a lot of children from developing nations or something, because in the extended family, the children run around in tribes, and there are cooperative child care, for example. That means that 12 children come to this house for one day, and then the next day they're in another house. So people would have adequate contact with people of all ages, having their lives enriched in that way, in the extended family.
Yes, well, this is certainly one way of looking, one perhaps step. But what about the next thing related to roles and genders? Is this the revival of the interest in rites of passage for boys and for girls? You know, the coming into one's own gender through a traditional initiation or rite of passage. And I think that a very strong case can be made for the need for these initiations and rites of passage. Now, it may be that traditional rites of passage, they've died out for the large part. Now, they're being revived by men's and women's groups based on traditional mythic models. If you wanted to have the androgyne as the model, then there'd have to be an appropriate androgyne rite of passage, so a child or young person could be inducted into the state of androgyny. I'm not quite sure what form that would take.
By simply not making a distinction between the initiation of boys and girls, you initiate adolescence, period.
Well, I suppose this is something like the metamorphosis of a butterfly, that we have, as we envision it at the moment, a world civilization in phase transition. In order to end up with a stable outcome with some chance in the future, we need to have many options. So even in villages, there might be initiatory experiences offered of different sorts and different traditions, and parents or committees in the extended family make a decision on, or the child himself, herself, would make a decision as to which of several different kinds of initiatory experiences, like what kind of summer camp to go to. You can go to music camp, or the Native American camp, or the physical culture camp, and so on.
Or the bisexual androgyne camp. Yes. Can't see many parents signing up their kids.
New traditions, myths, and so on of greater validity than old forms could conceivably evolve. I don't think it's going to work to choose initiatory rites from an encyclopedia of different rituals that were successful in Sumer or Babylonia or Native Americans, Aborigines, and so on. They all have faults, which they all have contributed to our arrival in this particular conundrum that we are suffering now.
So we seem to have gotten the children taken care of and the society taken care of, but we didn't make a whole lot of progress on the apparently eternal differences between sexually active adult men and women.
Well,
that was the part we shied off from.
Because I think that we did. Maybe I didn't make this clear. My proposal is that people will have voluntary monogamies if they wish. They'll understand to the beginning, whenever that ends for one partner or the other, then there would be a rejection. There would be a dissolution of the voluntary monogamy, and the suffering, jealousy, or whatever that falls upon the other partner who didn't want to stop, that this would be mitigated by therapies and rituals and practices within the extended family, which have to be evolved in order to accept this. And I think that this is, I mean, what else could have been the situation in tribal societies throughout our million years of development?
Well, what else was the situation and is the situation in many parts of the world is that it's not expected of men that they should be sexually faithful. And in many parts of the world, including Victorian England or contemporary Italy or certainly many parts of India, Thailand and elsewhere, it's taken for granted that they'll have, if not mistresses, at least visits to prostitutes or brothels. I mean, these are ancient institutions and they've been sustained through the millennia by the custom of men. And many of these men are married men, and wives have... There's been in the well-known double standard in matters of sexual fidelity, which perhaps has corresponded more to physiological needs and psychological urges, a differentiation of these in the sexes. At any rate, the idea of monogamy for men is a recent invention. It's, in fact, I think, an invention idealized by the women's movement. It was women put up with or accepted infidelity on the part of the men and yet remain married to them.
But it goes against Ralph's intuition that gender differences are not that important, and it has to make its peace with the modern epidemiological situation.
Well, I think that this is... We've arrived at an important point, and I'm glad we didn't quit before getting here, because this idea of the artificiality of male monogamy, of course, has to be applied symmetrically. And the monogamy of women, the fidelity of women, is an aspect of the patrilineal law, where in order for the property to pass from the father to the firstborn son, for example, is essential to know who actually is the father of the son. And for that reason primarily, I think, was invented the law for the monogamy or the fidelity of women. We have to give that up. We have to give up the patrilineal law in order to have any kind of stable society, I think, in which men or women well, but it, change sexual partners whenever they wish.
I think it goes deeper than that, because if you look at the homosexual community and assume that among male homosexuals behavior is going on completely without influence by the values of women, and that among lesbians behavior is ordered completely without regard to the values of men, you see that the sexual behavior of male homosexuals is vastly different than the sexual behavior of female homosexuals. Gay men have hundreds, sometimes thousands of partners, and this is not thought much of in a lifetime, where lesbians nest. They do not maximize sexual contact in the same way.
Yes, I think that's a strong point. And I think that these traditional differentiations of sexual roles in societies can be seen as reflecting it. I know from the point of view of modern feminist rhetoric that these are all appalling oppressions, these are roles imposed on women and so on, and I'm sure there's some truth in that. But male monogamy is, in fact, quite a recent invention. It's not expected in most societies I've heard of, even in biblical societies. You know, the what's held up to us as the very model of, you know, the Bible's full of stories of harlots and kings who had concubines and so on. It just wasn't the norm, even of the most sacred books of our religious tradition. And I think it's a kind of idealization that's come about quite recently. In the 18th century European society, it certainly wasn't the norm.
Well, let me try to get this clear. In our model village of the future, the men will not be expected to have contract of monogamy. Fine, but are you thinking then that women will volunteer for a faithful relationship with a man who's not in a reciprocal agreement of monogamy?
Well, less so than ever before, probably, because of the AIDS question. But one of the things, the point I was trying to make was that the invention of the nuclear family with male monogamy is, in fact, a very recent institution, not just the nuclear family, but the ideal of male monogamy may have existed for quite a long time, but the practice of it has existed a lot.
It probably arose with the nuclear family, post-industrial revolution.
Mm. So we're dealing, it's just simply amplifying an earlier point, that the ideals associated with the nuclear family, and together with the feminist-based ideal of completely reciprocal 50-50 relationships of all kinds, are based on a kind of legalistic approach to the problem, which may not correspond to deeper and unconscious habitual patterns. I'm not saying that habitual patterns are right and that this legalist approach is wrong, but I think that the attempt to apply these liberal legalistic models has failed again and again in relation to marriage, it's failed in relation to racial integration, it's failed in relation to communities, the behavior of nations, and so on.
Well, what I would imagine is that if a woman decides, let us say, to have one child, and she decides it's the time and so on, and then she may very well sleep with all the men in the village, or more likely, she might choose a parent. She might choose a father for the child. And having that in mind, that choice, she would then become monogamous, at least until she had the child. And then there would be between them, I suppose, some kind of contract or agreement as to what would, maybe a test agreement, what would happen in case they separated. And most likely that would be that the child stays with the mother. Maybe in exceptional cases, they agree that upon separation, the child will go with the father. Whatever agreement is made, if the child is 4, 5, 6 years old, the child may actually influence a modification of this agreement and go with the other parent or something. Anyway, in this situation, it is not important. I mean, patrilineal law is abandoned, and monogamy or sexual freedom would just be a choice of the individual, no matter what gender. And I think that this seems like a much better situation than we have today, and it could be stable. What would that mean, though, in terms of our actual wives? We have what seems to be the usual experience is that you get in relationship with someone, it becomes very intense in comparison with the relationship of other people around. You are sort of on a trip, as they say. And one thing that may happen is kind of a voluntary monogamy, if Wilhelm Reich is right, as I have experienced, that this natural state does fall upon people. And then you're in a situation which we have not exactly provided for in our model village of the future. And in case this voluntary monogamy then ends, there's a difficult situation that somehow has to be dealt with therapeutically.
More jobs for therapists.
What a depressing conclusion.
Grandmothers and grandfathers may be the most experienced and successful therapists in the extended family.
No, well then
grandparents do this therapy job.
Well, then we've got to evacuate Florida fast.
Yes.
Bring them all back.
Or I'll move there.
Well, no, I think that there's just a tiny footnote to the village thing. Instead of having old people funneled off to the retirement communities in Florida, then each model village should have maybe some, like almshouses in traditional English terms.
Oh, yes.
Small colonies of retired parents who would fulfill some kind of child-minding grandparenting role.
Yes.
And I would imagine it would be much more attractive if one were retiring and going away from where one spent on Cleveland, Ohio or something, instead of going to an old folks ghetto in Florida. You know, to go to just four or five vacancies come up every two or three years in Occidental California. You can go to one of those. There's a limited number, not enough to create a ghetto, and a way in which these are integrated into the community. This would be a major step forward, I think.
Yes, well, I think retirement in our future village would be an insignificant event, because one would not vacate the house or go anywhere. People requiring an exceptional amount of nursing care would go to special houses just two, three blocks away where this kind of care was available. The integrity of the extended family would then be preserved, and the only exit really would be death.
So as the king said to Mozart, there you have it.
Okay, lunchtime.
We've solved all the problems.
All the problems taken care
society
of.
Society with original solutions.